Hi, this is Paul. Last couple of weeks, had a couple of really cool conversations, one with Cale Zeldin, the other with Nate Heil, about Jordan Peterson and Pope Francis and their little Twitter thing. Cale responded to Nate and to Karen with a little tweet from Pontifex. A wonderful little tweet. Absolutely nothing wrong with this tweet. Every human person is sacred and inviolable. To ensure that a society has a future, it is necessary that a sense of respect be matured for the dignity of every person, no matter in what condition they find themselves. It's absolutely Christian, perfect, consistently Roman Catholic, consistently Christian, in my opinion, tweet. I wasn't really quite sure. You know, wasn't really quite sure the point that Cale was making, but it reinforced for me what rose in me during those conversations, which was, should the Pope be on Twitter? What does it mean that the Pope is on Twitter? I talked with Cale, and more specifically with Cale about that, because in some ways, having the Pope on Twitter kind of sort of puts the Pope down here where we all are. And raises the issue of, well, if the Pope is on Twitter, now, we also say, I think quite rightly, that there's probably zero chance that Pope Francis himself is writing these tweets. Now, as someone, you know, Bethel, who is certainly not Team Winsome, said, well, I don't see anything wrong with the tweet. Another person said, these are likely taken from... These are little bits and nuggets taken out of longer papal declarations or things, and they're put on Twitter as such. And I think, okay, it's certainly harmless. There's nothing wrong with that. But what that conversation with Cale and Nate raised in me was this question of exactly what is the Pope? Is the Pope an individual? No, clearly the Pope is an individual, rides around in a car, he's named. There's quite a bit of drama in some circles about this Pope versus Pope John Paul, who was our Pope Benedict, who were past favorite popes. But what is the Pope? And does the Pope sit on the throne of Christ? I've been playing around with ChatGPT again. I'm finding it, in many ways, sort of a nice alternative to Wikipedia. I think that's sort of how I see it right now, and I've been playing around with the Bing version of it. The Bing version of it is faster. Clearly, Microsoft has a lot more server power dedicated to their version of it than OpenGPT has and in their free version of it. I'm not giving them $20 a month. I'm just using the free thing. And so I asked ChatGPT, does the Pope sit on the throne of Christ? And those of you who are Roman Catholic and know this stuff far better than I am can maybe clarify and sharpen this answer. Yes, according to Catholic doctrine, the Pope, as the Bishop of Rome and the leader of the Catholic Church, occupies the position of the Vicar of Christ on earth. Now, vicar is one of these words that you hear coming out of the UK, but it's not something that we use very much in the United States, at least not in Protestant land where I live. This means that he acts as the representative of Christ on earth and as the authority to guide and to direct the church in matters of faith and morals. The term throne of Christ is not commonly used in Catholic teaching, so that was really very helpful. But it is sometimes used as a metaphor to describe the Pope's role as the successor of St. Peter and the head of the church. I wanted to get a sense of the definition of the word vicar, and ChatGPT actually did a pretty good job with that too. The term vicar comes from the Latin word vicarius, which means substitute or representative, vicarious as we would have in English. In the context of the Catholic Church, the Pope is considered the Vicar of Christ, which means that he acts as a representative of Christ on earth. This is based on the belief that Christ entrusted the leadership of his church to Peter and his successors, and that the Pope is the successor of Peter. As the Vicar of Christ, the Pope has the authority to teach, govern, and sanctify the church. I thought that was kind of interesting. And to make decisions on matters of faith and morals. In a broader sense, a vicar can refer to any person who acts as a representative or substitute for someone else. I think over a year ago, I think it was actually Kale who recommended this book by John O'Malley, Vatican One. I made it about halfway through the book on the first run, and I've restarted it because of these conversations that I've had. And because I'm trying to get my mind around this in terms of the conversation about individuals and bodies. Because part of what happens in the Protestant world is that throughout the history of the church, there's this tension between councils, synods, and bodies making decisions. You have the Council of Nicaea, and we have a degree of dis-ease with that because we have this sense that, well, it's political. In the Christian Reformed Church right now, there's obviously a big debate over what to think about in terms of same-sex marriage, and synods make these kinds of things, and synods have votes, and so all of this sort of gets into understanding the body. I had an extended conversation with a pastor from Washington, D.C., and some other people on Twitter over this in the follow-up from the video that I made this week. And so it got me thinking along these lines. The First Vatican Council, convoked by Pope Pius IX, 1846 to 1878, met in the north transept of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome about 7 months, from early December 1869 until mid-July 1870. That's, you know, just not too long after the American Civil War. It was the first ecumenical church-wide council in over 300 years and became the And because of the imposed implication of Pastor Aeternus, the decree of the council that defined papal primacy and infallibility, pundits predicted it would be the last such thing. The decree, they said, rendered councils superfluous. The Pope could now and should make all decisions. This gets into some of the Christian anarchism like Nate Heil likes to talk about. And when Nate Heil first told me this, I had always thought of anarchists as the kinds of bomb throwers that tried to assassinate the Duke Ferdinand in Franz Ferdinand in Serbia back in the day that kicked off the First World War. I always thought of anarchists as political anarchists. And then, of course, thanks to this little corner and all of you with your interesting ideas, you know, many more ideas surface. And it sort of also raised in me an idea about the sort of, it's not really anarchism, it's sort of body-directed nature of the kind of way that the United States didn't have a state church, but in some ways sort of had an invisible church. And so here's the idea that, well, in Vatican I, now we have all of this instantiation of papal primacy and infallibility. When on January 25, 1959, Pope John XXIII, announced his intention of convening a council that he soon named Vatican II, he shattered the pundits' predictions. Nonetheless, Pastor Aeternus, as a landmark in the history of the Catholic Church, its effects are keenly felt even today because of the decree alone, the council is worth studying. If the history is the story of how we got to be the way we are, then the narrative of Vatican I is the story of how the Catholic Church in relatively short time moved to a new and significantly more papal-centered mode, which is what the term ultramontane designates. During the course of the 19th century, the papacy lost control of the papal states and even the city of Rome. And by the beginning of the 20th century, the Pope stood almost alone in thinking that the loss could be recovered. Now that's very interesting because, of course, it gets into the formation of Italy as a nation state. You can study some of that. I am not very familiar at all with that process. And given this, I am more familiar with it now because, of course, what happens in the 19th century is the Pope goes from someone who is, in effect, ruling certain lands and papal states, as it were, to someone who's just sort of segmented into this little Vatican City, as it's called, which is a very small area of the much larger city of Rome. And that transition is a rather significant mental transition, I think, in a lot of ways beneath the surface. But also, by the beginning of the century, the popes had begun to exercise an authority over the church that was greater than ever before. Vatican I, the circumstances that gave rise to it and the circumstances that followed it were responsible for this remarkable change. Vatican I was the largest and most international ad hoc body to meet for the longest period of time in the entire 19th century. Although not immediately obvious, it was a solemn and defiant statement against the century's liberalism, especially since the term designated advocacy of representative forms of government, of freedom of religion, of separation of church and state, and of the secularizing programs in school and other institutions. Okay. One of the things, and this of course came up very strongly in my conversation with Nate, one of the things that has come to be a big center of discussion, not only in Catholic circles, but now in Protestant circles, is in fact liberalism. Liberalism, which in many respects is a product of the Protestant world. I'll say it in that way. It's helpful to remember that, for example, at the beginning of the 20th century and in the 19th century, you still had, and especially in the 18th and 17th century, you had some remarkably powerful monarchs. And a lot of what happens in the modern period is this wrestling between monarchy and democratic representation in governments, parliaments, which has pretty much become the rule in the Western world. Right now, most of the world seems to be run either by some kind of parliamentary government, might even be sort of, you know, like the UK, to what degree is the UK a monarchy when the monarch isn't political? And again, Nate and I spoke about that, that the monarch is more emblematic, that's sort of where things have settled. And then also strong men governments around the world, such as I would classify Russia in that vein, and even China. And, you know, strongman governments are a very long form of government, imperial strongmen, empires, basically, emperors, that the world has seen. They've been one of the more durable forms of government. And so then to think about the Vicar of Christ and someone sitting on Christ's chair as a human being, a living human being, and how to regard what that human being does, well, this is really a very big deal. The significance of the council thus extends beyond the issues internal to the Catholic Church. The leaders of the great political powers saw this and therefore followed the council with considerable concern. Their ambassadors to the Holy See concluded with journalists and others to obtain information about what was going on and what it might mean for the church, for church-state relations. If you read Tom Holland's Dominion, it's just bathed in these kinds of issues about church-state relations, as, of course, is the Protestant Reformation. Before the council met, Prince Chlodwig von Hohenlohe Schillingsfürst, Prime Minister of Bavaria, again, really, you know, no nation of Germany. Italy and Germany are still, haven't sort of coalesced into a nation state, published a circular letter warning that the council threatened to set the church against legitimate governments in Europe. William Gladstone and Emile Ollivier, representing the British and the French prime ministers during the council, were particularly attentive and hungry for information. After the council, Gladstone and Bismarck published tracts denouncing it, and Ollivier issued a 2-volume history and analyzed it. The impulse to define primacy and infallibility did not drop out of the heavens. It was the result of powerful campaign mounted at the grassroots level, largely by laymen. The campaign saw papal infallibility as the only viable answer to the cultural, political, and religious crisis ignited by the French Revolution and its pan-European Napoleonic aftermath. It was a crisis, the campaign maintained, that unless met head-on held the direct consequence for the Catholic Church, for Christianity, and for civilization itself. The only way to meet it was the unchallengeable, was with an unchallengeable authority. So in a sense, I have to be really careful here, it's looking to give a single man enormous power as opposed to, let's say, bodies. Distributed bodies. A synod is a body. A council is a body. And so, as the first sentence says, in a sense, the body gives authority to the individual. The supposed urgency of the situation helps explain why the 300-year gap between the Council of Trent, 1545 to 1563, and Vatican I, finally was closed. In the Middle Ages, between the First Lateran Council, 1123, and the Council of Trent, ecumenical councils met on an average of once every 40 years. It's basically two generations. Why, then, did such a large chronological gap yawn between Trent and Vatican I? As with every complex historical phenomenon, the reasons are multiple. Among them, however, three stand out. First, after the Council of Trent, the persuasion grew among Catholics that Trent had solved all the problems. What was now needed, if an issue required attention arose, was to see that what Trent had said, or in many cases, what Trent would have said. In other words, the council sort of becomes an extended body, and you look at the literature of the body, or you sort of mind read the body and say, here, in a sense, then, the council was Pope. The council was at the top of the hierarchy. Underlying this persuasion was the more widespread and fundamental belief that the Catholic Church had to present itself to the Protestant world as internally coherent and free of problems that were so pressing, a council was needed. In a church that did not need reform, and this is where we get into this question of reform. It's a big theme in Charles Taylor's A Secular Age, this question of, does the church have to change to address changing times? Now, of course, Protestant Reformation, Protestant churches are all about ongoing reforms. You know, always reforming is one of these reformed, of course, I'm a minister in a reformed church, but always reforming is part of the call that you'll hear in the Christian Reformed Church in the midst of all of this stuff going on about same-sex marriage. In a church that did not need reform, because Trent, of course, had solved it all, Catholics stood united against the ever-changing Protestant and secular world. By the 19th century, Catholic officialdom Sedulously. Why can't I say that word? Oh, sedulous. It's like a sedula. Interesting.
Sedulous.
Let's see, involving or accomplishment of careful perseverance, diligent in application or pursuit. The Bing chat says, sedulously means showing dedication and diligence. It is an adjective that describes someone who is diligent, careful, meticulous, thorough, assiduous, attentive, industrious, laborious, hardworking, conscientious, ultra-careful, punctilious, scrupulous, painstaking, searching, close, elaborate, minute, studious, rigorous, particular, religious. Wow. Yeah, that really went out of its way. All right. Sedulously avoided speaking of reform as applicable to the church. In other words, reform is not for us. Catholics, we're eternal. Now, boy, this stuff gets really interesting really fast. Protestants had co-opted the word and needed and the need to reform, to both which they were welcome. The second reason was the reluctance of popes to risk what a council might decide, especially regarding themselves and their office. From the First Lateran Council until the Council of Constance, 1414 to 1418, popes looked upon councils as their allies in addressing problems requiring serious attention. With Constance, things began to change. In 1378, the Great Western Schism broke out when two, then three men claimed to be the legitimate pope. Despite many serious efforts by rulers and churchmen to end the schism, it dragged on for some 40 years. Constance was finally able to resolve the stalemate, but only by taking the drastic measure of deposing two of the contenders, persuading the third to resign, and proceeding to elect a new pope, Martin V. Now, you have a problem in terms of visibility when it is, in fact, councils that raise up and bring down popes, because then you sort of intimate that councils are greater than popes. Popes are the products of councils. From that point forward, the relationship of pope to council became uneasy, to the point that at times the popes feared councils as if they were avenging angels. Their fear helped explain why a generation passed between the outbreak of the Reformation, 1517, and the opening of the Council of Trent, 1545. That council, which lasted off and on for 18 years, did little to calm papal fears. The prelates at Trent early on decided that reform of the papacy had to be one of their principal goals. Because of course a big issue was clerical reform and reform of the papacy and the Protestant Reformation. Although the three popes who reigned during the three periods of the council was in session resisted the council's efforts to that regard, in the end they had to yield in some instances. The council's reform measures did not fully satisfy the most ardent reformers, but for the most part, they were operated in good effect for the church at large. The third and most immediate reason for the gap was the acrid politico-ecclesiastical situation that began to develop in the middle of the 17th century and culminated in the latter decades of the 18th. In other words, the church has to deal with modernity, not just the Protestant Reformation. And modernity would come in, obviously, in one form via the French Revolution, but in many ways, really, with a vengeance with Napoleon and the ways that Napoleon reshaped the ideas in Europe about warfare. Of course, you had this great army that Napoleon wielded and, you know, nearly conquered all of Europe. But also the ways in which the nation state was transformed. Although the church wanted to show a unified front to the world, factions within it engaged in bitter disputes amongst themselves, and some instances forgot their differences to unite in challenging papal authority. This state of affairs was far too risky for a council. In other words, if you have a council, all of that conflict is going to be open to everyone in the world. And how can the church be this monolith of eternality to the world and show everybody all of the discussions that are going within it? By the middle of the 19th century, however, the situation had changed so thoroughly that Pius IX felt confident he could convoke a council. Catholics, now ready to forget grievances against the Bishop of Rome they may have had at an earlier time, had undergone one of the most remarkable changes in social consciousness, pay attention to the language, in modern history. Although the change was Europe-wide, France was its epicenter. It transformed itself from the most formidable proponent of the liberties of the local church vis-a-vis the Holy See, a central aspect of the phenomenon known as Gallicanism, to the most powerful engine promoting Ultramontanism, the 19th century movement that exalted central, that is, papal authority. Gallicanism, similar to Ultramontanism in its multifaceted aspect, was otherwise its polar opposite. And he goes into Gallicanism and Ultramontanism. If in the 19th century infallibility gained ground because of badly unsettled political conditions, its rise was just as due to the cultural, social, and intellectual challenges the modern world posed for the church. The scientific revolution threatened the Aristotelian system that had undergirded Catholic teaching since the 13th century. The rationalism of the Enlightenment upset the balance between faith and reason in traditional Catholic theology, and in its extreme form recognized no God but reason. That would be Steven Pinker. The French Revolution's cry of liberty, equality, and fraternity undermined ecclesial as well as political hierarchy. a problem compounded by the Industrial Revolution's creation of an urban proletariat, claiming, sometimes by sticks, stones, and muskets, a voice in affairs. The bourgeois' demand for freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion spelled, it seemed, the end of discipline required to maintain public order in church and state, and new forms of biblical criticism threatened the credibility of the Bible. These and similar phenomena constituted for most Catholics the major and most pervasive problems of the day and an opinion shared by Pope Pius IX. They challenged the very foundations upon which church and society had rested since time immemorial. The crisis was one of authority. Not all Catholics reacted negatively to these developments. There were liberal Catholics who believed that the church could and should embrace at least some of the tenets of liberalism. They maintained, for instance, that the church should shed its allegiance to monarchical forms of the ancien regime and align itself with the future, that is, with democratic or republican forms of government. They were an important but lonely voice. Now, it would be very interesting to know, where would the Pope stand today? Would the current Bishop of Rome, or even Pope John Paul II, who of course is attributed no small amount of influence in toppling the Soviet Union and ushering more democratic governments in very Catholic places in Eastern Europe, such as Poland? Does the Pope, for example, imagine that there should be some new realization of a monarchy in Poland? Or how about a renewed monarchy in France? There still is a titular monarch in Spain. Yes, Spain is still a monarchy. The Constitution declared that Spain is a constitutional monarchy and advocates the essential values of freedom, justice, equality, and political pluralism. Sounds pretty liberal to me. It also provides the separation of powers from the executive legislation and the judicial branches. The Spanish monarchy is currently represented by King Felipe VI, Queen Leticia, and their daughters Leonor, Princess Asturias, and Infanta Sofia. Well, there we go. Where would the Pope stand on this today? Would Pope Francis be in favor of democracies? Or would Pope Francis be in favor of the return of Roman Catholic monarchies? I mean, that almost sounds insane to think that in, let's say, France or Spain or Poland or, you know, any of these Catholic countries, how about a new King of Ireland while we're at it? We would have Roman Catholic monarchs whose job it would be to instantiate the religion within the country. And I'm really excited. I'm not trying to be a troll in any of this stuff. I mean, I'm just asking. And there might very well have been papal declarations that have, you know, come to embrace democracies. I don't know. I'm speaking out of ignorance, so inform me. Pius IX, however, would have none of it. He conceived the council as the church's negative response to liberalism and to the modern world that it had produced and then embraced. Remember, this is in the middle of the 19th century. This is not the 16th or 17th century. On his own, he had confronted the world with the Syllabus of Errors, 1864, which ended with the seeming catch-all condemnation of the idea that the Roman pontiff should reconcile with progress, liberalism, and modern culture. The problem became so pressingly urgent for him that it required a council to deal with it. He was not alone in this conviction, as Cardinal Luigi Lambruschini said to him as early as the pontificate in 1849, just 3 years after Pius IX was elected, "I think that your holiness should in time, the time could be distant, assemble a general counsel in order to condemn modern errors, revive the faith of the Christian people, restore and reinforce ecclesiastical discipline, which in our day has become so feeble since the evils are so general and a general remedy must be applied. When the council met 20 years later, the agenda closely corresponded to what Lambruschini indicated. Although the documents prepared for it did not contain an explicit reference to papal infallibility, in retrospect, we see that the ultramontane campaign and the opposition to it, opposition it aroused, led almost exorably to Pastor Eternus, which is an implicit but powerful assertion of the proper social and political order of society is hierarchical. As for Pastor Eternus, that Vatican I is remembered. Nevertheless, besides Pastor Eternus, the council published Dei Filius, should have taken Latin when I was in school, which dealt with the problem of religious faith with an increasing secular and skeptical world, a problem very much with us. As with Pastor Eternus, therefore Dei Filius makes Vatican I relevant today. How does that relate to this lovely little tweet from the Pope? Every human person is sacred and inviolable. To ensure that a society has a future, it is necessary that a sense of respect be matured for the dignity of every person, no matter in what condition they find themselves. Jordan Peterson, I think, would like this tweet, as would Nate, as would Karen, as would so say we all. When I read that, I thought about one of the things that Tom Holland said when we did this event with Glenn Scrivener in the UK during my trip this last summer. And I'm going to play that for you. I made a clip for it for Twitter as well. Now, he begins by basically saying exactly what Kale Zeldin said to me in our conversation about a joke from Louis C.K. And I thought, well, that's rather interesting.
That we you know, there's two things are too much, you know, there's too much fun, too much on Netflix, or, you know, I mean, there's we are never bored. You never hear the still quiet, you know, quite still voice of contemplation or anything. There is no space for that, and there was briefly in the pandemic, I think, and coming out of the pandemic, suddenly, you know, with all the theatres shut, the cinemas shut, music venues shut. You could go to church, you could hear music, you pay attention to the inherent drama within the liturgy, and it just seemed intensely exciting.
In other words, during the pandemic, somehow the church was amplified.
The question of how a church can make that seem as exciting as, you know, the return of Game of Thrones. I'm not pretending there's an easy answer to that one.
Well, just to spin on this a little bit more, you did talk about the, you know, like unashamedly talking about the old stories and not being ashamed of the Old Testament. And I'm getting back to what you said, Paul, about Jordan Peterson. That's exactly what he did, right? And that got quite a bit of attention. Anyway, that's just a reflection.
So what I think is that one of the reasons why I compare the 60s to the 1520s is that Protestantism in England, I'd say in the Netherlands, became very rapidly hegemonic. And people adjusted very, very rapidly to it. And people who had been Catholic priests adjusted to it very rapidly and started talking in Protestant terms, even perhaps when they weren't aware of it. So even the Council of Trent, you know, the smithy of the Counter-Reformation is unthinkable without the Protestant Reformation. The Catholic Church, is, as it exists today, is as much a product of the Reformation as the Protestant Church is.
And of course, I just read about that, how, oh my goodness, all of this reform, all of this change, the church has to stand eternal, unchangeable, just right here, never changing, because, you know, we serve a God who doesn't change, so therefore that should be the way it is.
And I think the risk for the Christian churches in the post-60s Western order is that they just they blur in and become part of the kind of hegemonic ideology, which is liberal, secular, skeptical, progressive. And you know, it's the thought for the day curse. You never hear anything on thought for the day that, you know, there's nothing particularly ever anything distinctive about anything that anybody says on thought for the day. It's always coming from the same kind of, you know exactly what everybody who goes on thought for the day thinks about pretty much every single issue. And it doesn't matter whether they're Catholic, Anglican, Methodist, Muslim, Buddhist, you know that they're all going to be basically articulating the same liberal nostra, because that is the hegemonic doctrine. Everybody thinks that. And I think that... Thought for the day is the God slot on the Radio 4 News. Oh. That is, I think, part of the charter that you have to have someone come on and talk about God for 5 minutes every just before the 8 o'clock news. And the BBC producers hate this so much that they find people who will say nothing distinctive at all. And I think I think along with the religious studies GCSE, which is what you study up until 15 or 16. Mm. It's the single fastest motor for de-Christianization.
And of course, that caught my eye. The single fastest motor for de-Christianization. And everybody laughs because it's a devastating point. Now, again, to look at every human being as sacred and inviolable. To ensure that a society has a future, it is necessary that a sense of respect be matured for the dignity of every person, no matter in what condition they find themselves. Fair enough. In many ways, this tweet validates Tom Holland's thesis in his book, one of his theses in his book, Dominion, that Christianity has won, that this is something that will be... Again, you can say, well, you know, abortion, and you can start talking about those kind of issues, and then suddenly it's going to be contentious, but in many respects, this is sort of thought for the day. But now remember, John Paul didn't just sit down here and type this, John Paul. Francis didn't just sit down here and type this. This probably comes from something that he had said, and he has a staff, and there's someone in the Vatican whose job it is to manage at Pontifex, and they are going to, in a sense, give the Catholic Twitter thought for the day and post these kinds of things. Okay, back to the question about bodies like individuals like us or ecclesiastical bodies. A bureaucracy is in many ways sort of an ecclesiastical body. This is a non-controversial thought for the day offered by a staffer at some place in the Roman Catholic hierarchy that is the vicar of Twitter for the Vatican, or the vicar of the Vatican for Twitter, which followed all the way up the vicar of Christ. Then on Twitter, I jumped to what I remember Tom Holland saying in an unbelievable broadcast about the pandemic. And it struck me as quite a bit of contrast, let's say.
You've been riffing off the themes of that in several articles and editorials and things. And most recently, one of the most recent ones I saw was in The Telegraph. And I don't know whether you choose the headlines for these things or not, but essentially the headline was something like church leaders need to stop being middle managers. But essentially the article was actually about, began at least with the way Christians historically have responded to pandemic and plague and that kind of thing. What were you trying to bring across in that article? And again, I'll make sure there's a link to it from today's show.
When the pandemic began and really kicked in, I remember one, that incredible appearance by the Pope in an empty St. Peter's Square with the bells clanging across the city and the distant wailing of ambulances, and these timeless prayers being spoken by the Pope. And then he stood before an icon of the Virgin and the Christ Child that had been sent to Rome in the pontificate of Gregory the Great. And I'd written about Gregory the Great in Dominion. And at the time, it seemed an unfathomable, you know, length of centuries, millennia ago. But Gregory became Pope during a terrible plague. And the story is that he leads procession asking for God's forgiveness. The plague arrows continue to rain down and then they stop. And the great statue of St. Michael sheathing his sword, which stands on the mausoleum of Hadrian as you approach the Vatican, is a kind of later rendering of that story. So watching that scene of the Pope before that icon, it felt like the ancient history that I'd been writing about in Dominion was suddenly coming alive and was kind of demonstrating its value, that there has been no institution, longer living institution, that has responded to the experience of pandemic than the Christian Church. I mean, there is nowhere in the world. And this is an immense reservoir that Christians and non-Christians can draw upon. And Gregory, in turn, had been writing a great commentary on the Book of Job, which, you know, is in many ways the bleakest, but perhaps for that reason, the most bracing book on the Bible about explaining why terrible things like plagues happen. And there was, it stirred up, I suppose, in me a feeling of everything that I've been writing about in Dominion, that there are these incredible depths, these incredible hinterlands, and that in a sense, Christianity provides an access to these depths and these hinterlands like nothing else in our culture. And to watch the Pope, I thought, this is incredible. This is in this terrible time, the Church is doing what it's always done, which is to justify the ways of God to man, and thereby perhaps to provide solace and comfort. And so I waited for more responses like that, for more, you know, whether it was the visual imagery of someone like the Pope standing in an empty square, or meditations or sermons or commentaries or whatever it was. And essentially, I haven't come across them because I'm not, accessing the right sources, but I didn't find them. And instead, what I was getting from church leaders here, and particularly from Anglican leaders, was essentially the kind of stuff that we were getting from ministers and from medical experts and from health advisors, which is excellent. Why not? Yes, important to convey those messages, but it's not enough, because the church exists to do something more. If it exists solely to broadcast health messages, then what's the point of it? And so I wrote the article basically to say, okay, fine, yes, give us your health messages, but please give us something more as well.
Very.
You put those things together, and they really hit hard. You will be my witnesses. Acts 1. The vicar of Christ. Now, of course, I'm a Protestant, so the Pope is not someone that I pay a tremendous amount of attention to. I am interested in it because I have friends who are Roman Catholic and I listen to them and I watch it, but I don't invest the Pope with that kind of authority. But I am very concerned about the nature of the Church's witness to Christ in the world. And of course, this gets into the question of saints and their bracing witness that sort of shines through. That's sort of by definition what a saint is and does, and it gets into the question of what are we looking for? You know, part of what leaps to mind is Dostoevsky, the Brothers Karamazov, and the Inquisitor. And behold, he deigned to appear for a moment to the people, to the tortured, suffering people, sunk in iniquity, but loving him like children. My story is laid in Spain and Seville in the most terrible time of the Inquisition, when fires were lighted every day to the glory of God. And in the splendid auto da fe, the wicked heretics were burnt. Oh, of course, this was not the coming in which he will appear, according to his promise, at the end of time, in all his heavenly glory. I'm working on those things for my sermon. In which will be sudden as lightning flashes from east to west. No, he visited his children only for a moment, and there were flames, and there were the flames crackling round the heretics. In his infinite mercy, he came once more among men in that human shape in which he walked among men for three years, 15 centuries ago. He came down to the hot pavements of the southern town, in which on one day, before almost 100 heretics had, ad majorem gloriam Dei, been burnt by the cardinal, the grand inquisitor, in the magnificent auto da fe, in the presence of the king, the court, the knights, the cardinals, and the most charming ladies of the court, and the whole population of Seville. He came softly, unobserved, and yet, strange to say, everyone recognized him. That might be one of the best passages in the poem. I mean, why they recognized him. The people were irresistibly drawn to him. They surrounded him. They flock about him, follow him. He moves silently in their midst with a gentle smile of infinite compassion. The sun of love bursts in his heart. Light and power shine from his eyes, and their radiance shed on the people stirs their hearts with responsive love. He holds out his hands to them, blesses them, and healing virtue comes from contact with him, even with his garments. You see, just all these New Testament stories just brought together. An old man in the crowd, blind from childbirth, cries out, "O Lord, heal me, and I shall see thee." And as it were, scales fall from his eyes, and the blind man sees him. The crowd weeps and kisses the earth under his feet. Children throw flowers before him, sing and cry, "Hosanna! It is he! It is he!" All repent. It must be he. It can be no one but him. He stops at the steps of the Seville Cathedral at the moment when the weeping mourners are bringing in a little open white coffin. In it lies a child of 7, the only daughter of a prominent citizen. The dead child lies hidden in flowers. "He will raise your child," the crowd shouts to the weeping mother. The priest coming to meet the coffin looks perplexed and frowns. But the mother of the dead child throws herself at his feet with a wail. "If it is thou, raise my child," she cries, a court holding out her hands to him. The procession halts. The coffin is laid on the steps of his feet. He looks with compassion, and his lips once more softly pronounce, "Maiden, arise," and the maiden arises. The little girl sits up in the coffin and looks around, smiling with wide open, wondering eyes, holding a bunch of white roses they had put in her hand. There are cries, sobs, confusion among the people, and at that moment the cardinal himself, the grand inquisitor, passes by the cathedral. He's an old man, almost 90, tall and erect, with a withered face and sunken eyes in which there is still a gleam of light. He is not dressed in his gorgeous cardinal's robe, as he was the day before when he was burning the enemies of the Roman Church. At this moment, he's wearing his old, coarse, old monk's cassock. At a distance behind him comes his gloomy assistants and slaves and the holy guard. He stops in the sight of the crowd and watches it from a distance. He sees everything. He sees them set the coffin down at his feet, sees the child rise up, and his face darkens. He knits his thick gray brows, and his eyes gleam with a sinister fire. He holds out his fingers and bids the guards take him. And such is his power, so completely are the people cowed into submission and trembling obedience to him, that the crowd immediately makes way for the guards, and in the midst of death-like silence, they lay hands on him and lead him away. Matthew chapter 26, just at the end of 25, I just finished my PowerPoint draft of my sermon, where at the end of these amazing apocalyptic parables, they conspire against Jesus, but they fear the people. Here the Grand Inquisitor has no fear of the people. The guards lead their prisoner to the closed, gloomy, vaulted prison in the ancient palace of the Holy Inquisition and shut him in it. The day passes and is followed by the dark, burning, breathless night of Seville. The air is fragrant with laurel and lemon. In the pitch darkness, the iron door of the prison is suddenly opened, and the Grand Inquisitor himself comes in with a light in his hand. He is alone. The door is closed at once behind him. He stands in the doorway and for a minute or two gazes into his face. At last he goes up slowly, sets the light in the table, and speaks. "It is thou, thou?" But receiving no answer, he adds at once, "Don't answer, be silent. What canst thou say indeed? I know too well what thou wouldst say, and thou hast no right to add anything to what thou hast said of old. Why then art thou come hither to us? For thou hast come to hinder us, and thou knowest that. And dost thou know what will be tomorrow? I know not who thou art, and care not to know whether it is thou or only a semblance of him, but tomorrow I shall condemn thee and burn thee at the stake as the worst of heretics. And the very people who have today kissed thy feet, tomorrow at faintest sight from me will rush to heap up the embers of the fire. Knowest thou that? Yes, maybe thou knowest," he adds with a thoughtful penetration, never for a moment taking his eyes off the prisoner. It is so often the curse of the church to turn wine to water. Jesus is so uncontrollable. Jordan Peterson often quotes Jung saying something to the effect that religion is created to basically keep the holy at bay. That's not a irreligious thing to say. I've often said that in many ways. One way to think about, let's say, the tabernacle and the desert wanderings is a divine containment unit. The King James talks about the Lord breaking out into the camp. He is a consuming fire. And Jesus comes, and the words of Christ leap off the page at us century after century. I am glad I am not sitting in the See of Peter in Rome, because in many ways it seems a no-win situation. To have your words assembled for Twitter as platitudes, I don't have an answer for you. But should the Pope be on Twitter? It's a hard question. Should the Pope be on Twitter? Should I be on Twitter? Should any of us be on Twitter? But of course, it's not just Twitter.